right. Bob, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited. We've been talking about doing something for quite a while. I want to introduce Bob Preschoell to my listeners. Bob is the executive director of the New England Forestry Foundation. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about what that is. I'm going to let Bob tell his story. So, Bob, if you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about why the New England Forestry Foundation is so important.
Thanks, Chip. It's good to be here. So the New England Forestry Foundation is 75 years old. We were founded to protect New England forests and to see that they were managed to the highest standards. The Forestry Foundation, we call it NEF, N-E-F-F, so I'll refer to it as NEF. NEF owns 150 properties, and the public is welcome to come on any of those properties. And in addition, we hold the conservation easements, meaning we hold the rights to the land so that they will never be developed, on over 1 million acres of land in New England. Give you an example, 1 million acres is bigger than the state of Rhode Island. So we're supervising a lot of land all the way from the Canadian border down to the shores of Long Island Sound. We've been working at it for a long time, and this is a pretty exciting period that we're moving.
So that opens a lot of questions in my mind. One, I want, how did you get all these forests? And they must be all different sizes, shapes, different types of woods, different types of situations as far as in their environment. And the second part of that, this could take a while to talk about, but why do you consider it to be such an exciting time?
Sure. Yeah. So a little bit more of the background. Most of the forests that we own are more in line with what we call family forests, meaning they're at the size of 20 acres, 50 acres, 100 acres, 300, a little bit larger. Our largest forest holding is 2,000 acres. So we fall within that range. Most of those size parcels exist in the southern part of New England. When you get into northern New England, the properties get much, much bigger. And owners of those properties are controlling hundreds of thousands of acres, up to 1 million acres. Not too long ago, there were some companies that owned over 2 million acres. There aren't very few of them now. But those properties up north are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, up to 1 million acres. So New England forests are very different if you're in the northern part of New England or the southern part of New England. So back to your question, most of our 150 parcels are that smaller family-sized parcel. But what's getting really exciting now is when we look at the northern part of New England and ask the question, what can our forests do for us in a time of climate emergency? We've got some very interesting opportunities in front of us.
Well, that's something I really want to know a lot about, because we're talking about the future, we're interested in the future, and you know what? Tell me that story.
So I set this up a little bit. We have to keep on thinking about these two kinds of landowners, the smaller family landowners and the larger, some people call them industrial owners, bigger parcels. So I'll move back and forth between the two and talk about the opportunities in both of these. But when you add them both up together, they are what New England can do as a whole. So let's start with the smaller forest owners. There's 215,000 of these people. They own forest lands, as I said, from 20 acres up to several thousand acres. And we call them family forests because most of them are owned by families. A lot of them live on their forest. Their homes are right there. And they're interested in wildlife and recreation and the beauty of the forest. Those forests have tremendous potential for management variety of things, management for wildlife, management for water quality, and management for production of timber products. Some landowners, but very few, decide to leave their property alone. They're never going to touch it. They'll never harvest a tree. And we encourage that. But that's very rare cases that family forest landowners do that because they have other needs. They have other desires for their forest. One of them being income to pay the cost of owning those forests. So we would like to see more of those smaller family forest owners use the services of professional foresters and do a better job of managing and meeting their needs. And that's been a chronic challenge for us for the last 75 years. There's 215,000 of them. They're difficult to reach and find. Their situations are always changing as their family situation changes. So you might talk to them one day when their kids are 3 years old and 4 years old, but then the life of a forest, when you come back in 10 or 12 years, those kids are about ready to go to college, and they're thinking about maybe the tuition cost of college. it might be time to do something with their forest to gain some income at that time. The forest and the attitudes towards the forest of these people change over time, and we know that. It makes them difficult to reach and educate. Also, they tend to sell their forest at some point in time, we get another landowner. So when we think of managing a forest and doing the right thing for a long time to encourage trees, which grow for a long time, we have to think in terms of 100, 100 plus years. During that period of time in the forest, we might have 5, 6, 7, or 8 different landowners on those forests, each of them going through family cycles, and each of them all along the way making decisions. If they make a bad decision in year 45, we've set the whole process off a little bit. So it's very difficult to locate these folks, get them managing in the right way, and if they happen to sell, pass it along to the next steward in the right manner and the right process. So we're trying to do that. We've been trying for 75 years. The biggest challenge with these family landowners is they're not using professional foresters. So their properties are not being managed and they're not optimizing their properties for wildlife or for the production of products. A forester can help these people make their forest 2, 3, or 4 times more productive in terms of what's grown on the forest. It's just like tending a garden. If you plant a garden in May and then you do nothing with it and come back the 1st of August, you know what you're going to find. You're going to find a lot of food, right? You're not going to get the potential of your vegetables. So along the way, we need to be weeding the garden, weeding the forest, selecting the best trees, the best growing vegetables in your garden for that matter, and encouraging those vegetables maybe by thinning around them. And that's what we, with a forest, professional forest cares can help you do that in the best way. We're finding, and across the country it's true, only 20% of these landowners, or 25% in some cases, actually use a professional forester when they do something in their forest. Well, that means 25%, right? So the figure basically is, if it follows pretty well across the country, that of every harvest that's actually done on a family forest property, only 20 or 25% of them have been done under the supervision of a forester. That means, that's like saying, we're going to go out and get an appendix operation, but we're not going to use a doctor. We'll use somebody that doesn't have the skill. So our job is to introduce the foresters to these landowners and get more of the forest managed in a professional way and get them more productive. So that's been an ongoing challenge for the family forest owners in Southern New England.
What is your educational program like to reach those people? What are you doing?
Well, there are foresters available. And that's how NEF, my organization, started 75 years ago. At that time, there were not the foresters available even to work with the landowner. So NEF established itself, and the first thing it did is hire 12 or 15 foresters and send them out to the different areas in New England and say, go establish yourself, establish a forestry center, live there, raise your family there, and offer your services to the landowners near you. So we did that with our staff of foresters for about 50 years. At that point in time, through other forestry schools education, there became enough foresters available, they're called consulting foresters, that were established, and I was one of them, and I had my own business at one time, that had established themselves around New England and could offer these services. And NEF decided at that point, the nonprofit organization that we were, no longer needed to do that. The market was taking care of that service. We had actually met our goal. That's what we wanted to have happen. And we transitioned into a different kind of organization. We turned those foresters loose. There were 15 of them. They formed their own consulting outfit, and they still exist today, and we still use their services. New England Forestry Consultants. There are 15 of several hundred foresters that are around the region waiting to help these family forest owners out.
I would think that there are a lot of people that have these family forests that almost live in a vacuum. They aren't really aware of that. I'm not sure that that's actually the case, but they'll see a tree and say, well, we're going to go cut that down. Or there's a guy that has a tree service in town. I'll have him go and cut a bunch of the trees down or something like that, as opposed to having a real clearly managed program to take care of their property. Right.
Yeah, that's what happens. And it's about education. Most of these landowners really don't understand how a forest grows and how you can make it more productive. And as I said, I was a consulting forester. I talked to hundreds, probably thousands of these family landowners. I explain what my skills were and what I could accomplish for them. Of course, I had to be paid. So they had to pay me in order to get a more productive forest. And for some people, it was, well, a guy showed up last week and offered me $100,000 to cut all my trees over 12 inches. And that sounded pretty good to me. And now, Mr. Purcell, you're telling me you're going to charge me to mark some of my trees, not all of them, but some of them, only take some of them out. And I'm going to, you estimate $30,000, but I'll grow the rest of the trees for another 20, 30, or 40 years. When that's presented to some people, most consultants, when they get the chance, are pretty successful in convincing people, but not everybody. Some people say, it's time to take the money, I'm moving on. And
Well, especially people that might be older and they're thinking about things in a different way, right?
Yeah. And some people never get the chance to talk to the professional forester. And that's what we've been trying to do, to make these folks aware that those services are available. If you want to talk to one of these people, just give them a call. They'll come out and they'll talk to you. So we've been trying to do that for a long time with limited success. The problem has always been there hasn't been enough money to do the communications. And the results show only 20 or 25% are using the services. And so this is something, as we talk more, we'll get into, well, how could we potentially now get enough money to communicate better with these people?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the larger landowners, you know, that big industrial size, you know, million acres or something.
Yeah, let's move to them. So in an era of climate change, when we think about our forest and what it can do in the next 10 or 20 years while we're going through this emergency, we really need to take action now or we're going to go right through these climate limits. We don't want global warming go more than 1.5 degrees centigrade. It looks like we're going to head in that direction unless we move really fast and stop burning coal and fossil fuels. Another option here is to also sequester more carbon. So if our trees can absorb the carbon while we're cutting our emissions of fuel, we're going to get to our goals a lot faster and maybe there's some hope in the future. So we look at our forest and we ask a couple of questions. I'll start with the first one is, you know, how can we sequester more carbon in our forest? And the second connected question is, how can our forest produce more products that would substitute for products that put a lot of carbon in the air, like concrete, like steel, like plastic? So how can we produce more products? So with the Southern New England owners, part of the answer is use a professional forester, manage your property better. You might double your production, right? So those that twice as many products from wood would be available to replace carbon intensive products like concrete and steel. So that's one way that we can help the Southern New England landowners participate in solving the climate emergency. Now, when we look at Southern New England, I'll make the comparison here. Since these landowners have done very little management, these forests, most of them are pretty well stocked, which means they have a lot of trees, just like your garden. If you walked away in May and didn't come back until August, you'd have a lot of vegetation. Not all of it would be good or wouldn't all be your crop, but you'd have a lot of biomass. And that's what the case is in Southern New England. We've got quite a bit of carbon per acre. Now, go to the northern part of New England. These are the larger landowners. They're industrial owners. And some of these properties are owned by investment companies that have taken money from pension funds. Maybe California Pension Fund puts a lot of money into one of these funds and they buy land in Maine. Another example is Yale University, through their endowment fund, has an arrangement where they're basically invested in about 1 million acres of land in Maine. So what's happened up in the northern part of New England is there's been a degrading cycle of forestry for the last 50 years, where the stocking on these forests have been going down, lower and lower. And that is a result of the economic cycle. So these owners buy the property for a particular price. They make an investment in them and they have to return the investment to their owners, which means they can't wait 50 or 100 years for the trees to grow. They need to figure out how to make their investment within 10 years. And that means cutting the trees. So what's happened up there is the stocking has been reduced. Give you an example. The average stocking in Maine is 15 cords. The stocking in Southern New England could be maybe in places two or three times that.
So what does stocking mean? Explain what that statistic is.
Well, it means a variety of things, but you can think about it in terms of the number of trees or the number of large trees. It's basically the amount of wood or biomass on a particular acre. And as a forest gets older, it starts to build up its stores of biomass. When it's young and just begins, let's say it was a field and you left the field alone. In New England, if you leave a field alone, trees seed in automatically in most cases. Right at the beginning, in year one or two, you could find a couple of little seedlings, but there's not much wood, biomass, material on the forest. Those trees start growing, and in 5-10 years, you might have thousands of trees for every acre, but they're all like pencils. They all start growing a little bit longer and compete with each other. Some of them lose the race. Some of them become the dominant crop trees. And so you reduce. Now your stocking is naturally reduced in the forest from thousands of trees to hundreds of trees. And as you go through the decades, 10, 20, 50, 80, 100 years, you have fewer and fewer, but bigger and bigger trees. If you think in your mind about what you might envision as an old growth forest or an older forest, it's big trees, but there aren't that many of them per acre. During this process, the storage of carbon, which is particularly important, is going up. We have more and more carbon sequestered, stored, locked in on the site, on the forest, as we go up. Now, when you manage a forest, if you left the forest alone, it would reach a higher level of stocking, but then you wouldn't get any wood or products out of it. So our wilderness forest and our unmanaged reserve forest are packing in carbon and storing a lot of carbon, and that's a good thing. We should leave some of our land alone to do that. We also need forest products, so we are going to have to manage some of our land. When you begin to think about those managed lands, the question is, how do you manage them to both get a lot of products out of them, but keep a lot of carbon stored on the site? And that's the challenge of forest management. So what's happened in northern New England is the economic cycles have caused them to harvest the trees when they're pretty young. So they'll grow the trees up there from maybe 30 years, maybe 40 years old, then they cut them all down and start all over. Those forests could be a lot more productive, meaning we could produce more products per acre and store more carbon if we would just let the trees grow longer, let them grow to 50 or 60 or 70 years and manage them with professional expertise. We can actually produce more per acre.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the economics of that, because I'm sure these large companies have looked at that in some way, and or they're looking at it short term as opposed to long term. So how do you convince them to change their models?
Well, I can't. That's the problem. So when I say more per acre, if you have low stocking on your forest, let's say like in Maine, the average stocking in Maine is 15 cords per acre, but a lot of these owners have less than that. They might have 12 cords per acre. The really well-managed forest up there, like what New England Forestry Foundation does or other really good landowners, they might have 24 cords per acre. So you have a difference in stocking between 24, 15, or even lower, 12 or 10. The difference in production there is about three times. If you're growing a forest and you continually keep it at 15 cords per acre, you're probably only producing 2/10 of a cord per acre every year. If you have 24 cords per acre and keep your stocking that high, you can produce three times 0.6 cords per acre per year. So you're getting more per acre. It's like a farmer getting 6 bushels of corn instead of 2 bushels. Which one would you want to do? I'd want to get right. Well, in order to get the 6, you got to wait until August, right? In order to get the 6 here, you got to wait 50 years. So you asked a good question. The problem is, as I said, these companies take investment money and they're supposed to give them a return on their investment of whatever the pension fund, let's say, wants, or whatever Yale University. It invests in its endowment. It would like to see a return of, let's just grab a number, 8%. So now they buy forest land in Maine. They need to get a return of 8%. We could probably get them a higher return, but not in the first 10 years. They would have to wait 40 or 50 years, and then you would average out at a higher rate of return. But they can't wait. Most of these companies only own the land for 10 or 12 years, and then they sell it. So we're in a quick, fast game of economics at a high rate of return over a short period of time that doesn't match up to the natural productivity and cycles of a forest. That's our problem. how do we bring the economics in alignment with the actual growth of a forest? So this is where we get into the big opportunity, right? Yeah. So if you look at northern New England, you see what I call a carbon bucket. Those millions of acres of land out there are low stocked right now. If we just let the forest grow some more, it could pack carbon and sequester it in those forests. That's really important in a time of climate change. So we looked at what if we applied the right practices up there, and then we extrapolated from that, and we were stunned with the size of this. If we let our forests grow to those maximum levels under management, it would be the equivalent of taking every vehicle in New England off the road for 20 years. All the carbon, all the vehicles in New England emit for 20 years, we could sequester that in these northern forests. If we could find a way to encourage those landowners to change their management and wait longer to harvest the trees. So now we look at this and we say, well, there's a big carbon benefit. Shouldn't we, meaning the state, the nation, the world, make an investment for climate change to help these landowners sequester that carbon? And that's what we're trying to put together right now. We know that it's big, and now we have to figure out how much would we have to pay those landowners to grow their trees longer, and who would pay it? So there are carbon trading schemes, and our governments are spending money to mitigate climate change by building windmills, by building solar, by helping people retrofit and make their homes more energy efficient. We're doing a variety of things, but it's not enough. So what else we do? Well, one of the things we could do is let our forests grow some more, right? And can we pay those landowners enough for them to change their land owning, land management strategies to allow this to happen? And how much would we have to pay you?
Have you looked at the economics of that to see what it would actually take from an investment standpoint to get them to change their models?
We're beginning to look at it. This is our goal now. We don't have the actual numbers, but we're beginning to do some pen and paper work, you know, pencil to scope that out. The reason why we're so interested in figuring this out is it would seem, on the face of it, that it could be real cost effective. So basically, a landowner, we're not asking them never to harvest their trees again. In order to do that, we probably have to buy their property. I mean, there's no return for them if they can't harvest anything. So really what we're saying is under our scheme, allowing the trees to grow longer, in the next 10 or 20 years, maybe you'll only make 2 or 4%. Your goal was 8. You need to make 8. So we need to fill the gap between 4 and 8. Look at that. We think that could be cost effective when compared to building windmills, building solar, doing other potential things to mitigate climate change. And in addition, as you're letting the forest grow older, you're getting better wildlife habitat. You're getting better water quality. You got more trees cleaning the air. It's a more beautiful place to recreate and go up to Maine or these places and spend some money and help the rural economies. There's a lot of side benefits that go along with this that make it different than building a windmill 20 miles off the coast, which the windmills are great and they're going to be really important. But what are the added benefits to having a windmill out there other than giving us renewable energy?
Right. So there's a different way to approach subsidizing these industries. And it seems that you're suggesting, right, by doing this, you get a lot more people going up there to go on vacations, spend time in the woods, go camping or do whatever. They spend money in that area. They build up businesses. They help the local economies so that there are second and third order consequences of a positive nature, which seems pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, well, we call it a win-win-win. So there's four wins in here. The one that you just started to talk about is the rural economies, right? More trees, more management, more production leads to more and better jobs up there. You know, bigger trees can produce better jobs and better products and more value added than smaller trees. So there's an advantage to rural economies. There's an advantage to wildlife. You know, the bigger trees, the older forest, and our ability to understand the needs of wildlife habitat and actually have the money and availability to work to create that will improve the wildlife habitat in these areas. We were talking about climate change. That's the third win, right? We can win on climate change here. This could be a significant carbon mitigation strategy right here in our region. So I'm up to three. The fourth one brings us into this other very interesting area about building tall buildings with wood. So that's
This is something I want to I want you to talk about, because since you mentioned that to me in a previous conversation, I've been poking around. I poked around on your website and linked to a couple of other websites. Really interesting stuff, I must say.
So that's what we call the fourth win here, is that right now we build taller buildings, meaning buildings that are more than five stories tall. That's what we were talking about when we say tall buildings, right? We build those buildings out of concrete and steel. The whole world has. We have since 100 years ago, more than that, and we've stuck with it. That's been the technology of building. But now we're able to build these buildings out of engineered wood products. So you take boards, they're 3 or 4 inches across, you lay them down, and then you lay boards across them in a perpendicular manner and glue them together. You can do 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9 layers of that. You can basically, with this, it's called cross-laminated timber, and you can make almost whatever you want out of that, a very strong beam or a whole section of a wall of an apartment. It can be created in a factory off-site and then trucked to the building site. So in the factory, they know exactly what the specifications for that wall is, how big it is, how thick it is, how long, how high, where the plumbing goes, where the electrical outlets goes, all that's drilled in and set up in the factory. And then it's put on a truck, it's brought to the site. All they need to do is lift it off the truck with a crane and bolt it in place, and you've got your wall. And these things, doing it like this, almost like an erector set, the buildings go up really fast, and there's very little traffic to the site. So one study I showed, they would have required 1,000 trucks to come in with the concrete and steel, and they built the same size buildings out of wood, and they only had 93 trucks come in. So it really reduces the traffic, which is great for the neighborhood because it's so disruptive, and it reduces the amount of people on site because you can put these things in place with only a few people. It's just the crane operator and somebody, two people bolting them in the wall, so reduced costs. So these buildings can now be built out of these materials, and they're being built around the world. The win here is it's also another carbon win. You know, you're not producing steel and concrete. You have to heat these things over 1,000 degrees to make steel and concrete, and that causes a lot of carbon pollution. So instead of using the steel and concrete, if we can use wood, we're actually helping mitigate climate change by offsetting those emissions. So that helps the climate. It creates the jobs in the rural economies to make these panels, but it gives people more affordable housing and beautiful places to live. These are beautiful buildings with exposed wood, and people are attracted to them. They love living in them. So there's a lot of advantage. The architects love them. They're lighter. They're more flexible. If you need to make changes with the building at some point in time, it's a lot easier to do that with wood than steel and concrete beams. They're tested for earthquakes. They bend and they sway in earthquakes, and they're better things to have in earthquakes. You know, one key issue is fire. Everybody, you know, of course, worried a wood building won't it burn. But these are engineered panels, and it's like trying to light a large log with a match. You can't do it. And so these have been tested. The government testing agency built a series of apartments, furnished them, and then went in and set them on fire and observed what happened. So everything in the apartments burned up, but the wood walls made out of engineered wood did not burn. They just char and the fire goes out. So the engineered wood can be fire safe. You have to build the buildings in the right way. You have to have the right sprinkler systems, but they will meet the codes. So codes for taller buildings are changing now. The international code has changed. It will take effect about a year from now, next January. And each of the states then decide whether they adopt that international code. They usually do, but it's up to each state. So now we're beginning to see the trend towards these buildings. The U.S. has been behind. If you did your Googling and looked at some of these websites, you saw these buildings in Europe, in Norway, in Canada, but not many of them in the U.S. They're starting to go up, but we don't have a lot to show yet. We're kind of behind the game a little bit. We need to catch up.
So why do you think that is? And also, how big can you build these buildings? I mean, it's two different questions.
Well, An architect has shown me a design for the Empire State Building to make the case that, you know, there's really no limit. I think the important thing to, and there are buildings that are 18 story tall right now being lived in by students out in Vancouver in a college dorm. So, and there are designs for 40 story buildings and even taller. I think Japan has a 70 story building with a design that they say they will build someday in the future. So we can go up taller. The key to remember here as far as climate change and buildings is it's not the tall buildings that are important. There really aren't that many of them around the world. Our problem going forward in climate change over the next 10, 20, or 30 years, the critical emergency period here, is we're going to have 2 billion more people on this planet. And a lot of people are moving around the globe, moving out of the countryside into cities, particularly in China and Japan and other places. But it's happening here in the U.S. as well, to some extent. We have to provide urban housing for a lot of people, over 2 billion people coming up. The mayor of Boston just a couple of weeks ago said they need, I think it was 69,000 new housing units in short order. It's a real problem in Boston. If we build all those buildings out of steel and concrete with all the emissions that come out of that, we're cooked. We can't meet our climate goals by building in that way. Even if we do good on transportation and heating and everything, we can't continue to build out of concrete and steel and hope to meet our climate goals. So building with wood is one way to make sure that we don't get into those dangerous situations. But the important point about the height is that when you actually look at the number of buildings existing or that would be built in the next 20 or 30 years, most of them, by number, are between 5 and 12 stories tall. You just don't have a lot of 100-story buildings or even 30-story buildings.
I just wonder, from an abstract level, you know, you think, oh, I wonder how big you can actually build those things, right, with wood. You never think, oh, a wood building, you're going to go up that high? You know, it's pretty amazing to think about.
Right. And we all get, my point is, we get excited about the big buildings, the tall buildings, because we can point them out and they're charismatic. But it is in the tens and hundreds and thousands of 5 to 12 story buildings where we're really going to get our big change here. We're really going to get our climate impact. And what's happening now here in Boston is up to 5 stories. The buildings are now built out of wood. It's stick wood, 2x4s. And you've probably seen them driving by when you've seen buildings going up, this sort of forest of wood in there, right? That's not engineered wood. And that does have some fire problems. They have to have the right sprinkler systems because those will burn, and they have. But you can go up 5 stories with the stick wood. Once you go above 5, you can't go above because it won't, architecturally, you can't do that. You need engineered wood to go above 5 stories. So once you hit 5, now you have to go to concrete and steel. The problem is concrete and steel isn't cost effective until you're over 12. Now we've got a gap. Nobody wants to build between 5 and 12 stories. So you wind up with situations like the transportation hubs in Boston, where we're getting some housing going in near the Alewife station, for example. The buildings that are going in, 5-story max, we should have 12-story buildings there, but we're not getting them. We're only getting 5-story buildings. Engineered wood can solve that. We can go up to 12 stories with engineered wood. We densify those areas, keep people close to the transportation hubs. And now you get another benefit. Maybe I ought to say there's win number 5 here, because the next benefit is you save on transportation if you can densify the areas around the transportation hubs.
So what about our supply chain? You know, when I think about doing something like that, do we actually have enough wood to build all these buildings?
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. And there's a couple of questions in your remark there. One is, can we grow enough wood and is it out there and available? But the associated question is, can we manage it and do it in the right way? And that's really, when we've reached this point where I've made a lot of points that this is a very great opportunity for us. We've reached a point with the architects, the environmentalists, the climate people, where folks are understanding that this could be really major. The architects love it. The fire code people are getting close to accepting it. As I said, the codes are changing. You know, so we're making a lot of progress. The one obstacle that we have right now is the very good question of, all this sounds great, but what's going to be happening in the forest while we're producing this wood for the great buildings that we want to see in Boston? Is the forest going to be managed well, or are you just going to, the builders will ask for the materials and it will be done in a poor way in the forest, and we'll lose the carbon in the forest and we'll hurt wildlife in the forest and we'll have a worse climate impact because of what's the damage that's going on in the forest. So the climate folks and the environmental folks that are looking at this are rightfully concerned about what kind of management is going to produce the materials for these buildings. We've seen examples of harvesting over the past that have not turned out well, and people are rightfully worried about this. So what we've done in New England is establish what we call exemplary forestry standards. So we've looked at the forest practices in New England and described a set of standards that if you follow them, things will be okay in the forest. If you follow these standards, you'll keep your stockings high, you'll provide for the wildlife and water quality, and still get the material out. And we can prove that because we can bring you to our forests that we've done this on for 75 years and show you that we produced a lot of wood, but we have more carbon than when we started. There you go. That's what we could do. But you won't necessarily get that effect unless you practice these kind of forestry practices. So now we provide the link and we're beginning to do the analysis and the modeling. If you do these practices, how much carbon will you have in the forest 30 years from now? How many products will you produce? How many buildings could you have built out of those products? How much carbon and steel would you have offset in the carbon emissions of that? And what's your total systems mitigation from doing all of that together? So all these pieces need to be tied together. And up to now, they've been looked at separately. And sort of somebody looks at the forest, but they don't look at the buildings. People look at the buildings, but they don't know what's happening in the forest, right? You have to have a systems approach and do the analysis over the whole system and then bring it all together in one place. And that is precisely where we are at this moment in time, is beginning to do these studies. And our first one is of a 5-story building. If it was built in Boston, 5 stories out of engineered wood, produced in Massachusetts and grown in the forest of Massachusetts under these standards, what would be the result? And so we think we're the first ones to put it all together. Stay tuned. It's taking us a few more months and we'll have it.
That is so amazing. I mean, to think when you start to extrapolate that out and look at bigger construction projects besides just that one building and think about all of New England and all the construction that needs to happen, whether, you know, you're going from, you know, the New York Connecticut border all the way up to Maine and what's being built in New Haven and Hartford and Springfield and Boston and Providence and Portland and all those various places. If you could really show that it's a sustainable and environmentally worthwhile project, I bet you get people very, very excited.
Yeah. I encourage your listeners to do a little Googling, go out there and do some searching. There's a lot of interesting things that you can find. One is to check out, I think it's Alphabet, the company, and their Toronto plans. So they're building a whole Toronto waterfront out of wood. That's their intent to do that. Another thing to look at is, I mentioned the fire. There are videos that show these apartment buildings that they constructed and furnished and lit on fire. You can watch them do that and watch that go out. Every once in a while, it pops up. There's an old photo of a fire where a total building was totally consumed. And there was a wood beam still intact with a steel beam melted and draped over the wooden beam, which gives you an example that steel and wood react very differently to fire.
Is this like, these are YouTube videos?
Well, it was a still picture that I found of the wooden beam. But yeah, I think there are YouTube of the other things. Check out tall wood buildings around the world. These are beautiful buildings. You know, you can look at them. The architect's designs for new ones are sometimes in the world of fantasy almost. They're really, really very creative. And it gives you an example of the interesting things that can be done. But the one chilling thing that I encourage people to look at is start Googling tall building construction in China or tall building construction in India. We have a scale here. You talk about Boston. It's a relatively small city, actually, you know, but it's big here in New England. You look at some of these pictures. There are cranes and buildings going up to the horizon in some of these places. You know, there is tremendous construction going on in those countries. And of course, they're all steel and concrete. And that's what I meant by 2 billion more people will be on this planet. And we're going to have to provide places for them while we're mitigating climate change. And the only answer we have right now is wood. There's no other material that can build a building and still do something positive for the climate. Although I did read yesterday about a new idea about building buildings with fungus. Fungus, yeah. Yeah. Believe me, we're not close. It's just an idea, but there's a possibility of using fungus to grow and regrow and then stop growing and then add to the building. And I guess the NASA, you know, with their space exploration has considered this. If we're going to have a community on Mars, how do we house them? Maybe we could do it with fungus. So my point is right now, we really don't have another alternative. It's our old friend wood that is going to have to save us here in the construction world, at least in the next 20 or 30 years. After that, maybe somebody will come up with something a little bit better, but right now we don't have it.
So let's talk a little bit before we close out about the opportunities ahead as far as like, and the problems, the challenges ahead to change people's minds and also raise the money that you need to do these studies and do the marketing and education and all that, these type of programs, which seem to be pretty essential for success.
So when we look at our program, we identify a series of challenges before we can get to our goal here. And I've talked about some of them already. We talked about fire, about code, building codes. Up until recently, you couldn't build a building out of wood over five stories. It wasn't to code. You would have had to go for a variance and prove that your building would stand up and not fall down and wouldn't burn. But that cost extra money every time you have to go to a special variance. So until it's in the code, you shouldn't expect to get a lot of building going up with wood. Well, the code is changing. That challenge is beginning to go away as of January 1st, 2021. The codes will change and allow buildings up to 18 stories. And I'm sure they'll be adapted after that, but that opens the door for this. So we think that challenge about code is starting to be resolved, right? Another bigger challenge is in any new technology, we've built out of concrete and steel for over 100 years. If you're a construction company, you've just built 50 buildings. Your last 50 buildings have been concrete and steel. You know how to do it. You know what to expect, and you're experienced with it. Now we're asking these people to do something totally new. They've never done it before. And we know that when you're faced with that, not everybody jumps on board right away. You get your innovators and your first adopters to it, people that are willing to take a chance, that want to do something new, that push the edge. But there aren't that many of them. And once you get those, then the others follow after that. And so one of our challenges has been, at least in the U.S., we need to get some buildings up that we can point to and convince people that it works. And we have to find those creative, innovative architects and builders and financiers that are willing to do this. Now, we do have some buildings. There's a building at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. It's four stories tall. It's beautiful. Go visit it. You can see this wood inside. Mystic Seaport, their visitor center, was built a number of years ago using some of these panels. And the Rhode Island School of Design has a building now that's inhabited now. They built it over the summer that uses the materials as well. So we do have buildings, and it's being used internally with places you can't see it. But we don't have a charismatic building that would change the minds and create the rush in this direction. And we're still waiting for that. So I think that's still a challenge here in New England and New York.
Do you have like architects, more architects that are interested in looking into this or talking to you or you're talking to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are groups of people when we meet, we talk, we share stories. We're all trying to push this forward. And I've had architects tell me they want to be the first one to build these buildings in Boston. They know it's the future. They know it's going to happen. They want to be known as a creative and innovative firm. They love the material and they want to do it. Well, they have to find somebody to pay them, right? They have to find somebody that is willing to pay for the building and make the match. And, you know, they're saying within a year, we'll have it. Somebody will be there, but we haven't seen it yet. So we're still, that's our challenge. We're still waiting for that. You know, there are some programs the government can help here in pushing this along a little bit. There are competitions. you know, for the best wood building design and awards for that. These can help a little bit. The state governments, like they've done around the world, can say, for any government building that's going to be built, we want to see a wood design. We're not going to demand that it's built out of wood, but we want you to have a wood design to sit next to the concrete and steel design, and then we can make a decision. That would be pretty helpful to get something like that. And it's been used in other places around the world. But we're still trying to break through that innovative, creative, early adopter stage into massive use. But I think it's coming. Not as fast as we want. So that's another challenge. And then we also talked about the forest management challenge. That needs to be addressed. And that's our bread and butter. I mean, we're not builders. We're not architects. But we are foresters. And we know how the forest works. And we know the right standards to use in the forest. So that's what our job has been, to articulate those standards. You can find them on our website. Those standards, if followed, will assure the public that we get the right amount of carbon in the forest and the forests are going to be healthy and managed right. And then we can plug that into the rest of the system. The last challenge that we haven't talked about yet is this material isn't made in the East at all. If you want to build a building now, you'll have to buy it from Europe, the material from Europe or from Canada, or from the Western United States. So we've got, there's no engineered wood factories. So you got to ship them a long way, and that costs more money. So now so that's why some of these buildings aren't going up. If we could produce them here in the region, it would produce jobs in the region. It would utilize our well-managed forest, and it would cut down the transportation cost and make the buildings more cost-effective. So what we've done to meet that challenge is we did a report by an international firm that was able to take a look at New England, our forest types, the wages that we have to pay people in New England, the power usage and the cost of the power, and ask the question, could we make these panels, CLT panels, here in New England and be worldwide cost competitive? And their answer was definitely. You've got the right species, you can locate these things and produce these things, and you'll be cost competitive. So we've got three or four different outfits that are saying they're building a plant. They're not ready yet, but within a year, we should start to see this happening here in New England. But that's part of the thing that we need to make sure that happens as well.
God, this is really exciting stuff, and it gives me like hope. You know, there are clearly challenges in getting this done, but everything that you've described seems very doable. You know, education, marketing, getting the right people at the table, changing some of these building codes. It's a lot of footwork for sure, right? A lot of phone calls and meetings and whatever. But God, to see some of that stuff happen would be just so incredible.
I like that you said it gives you hope, because it's part of our message too. You know, I'm sure you've done other interviews with people where you've probably talked in detail about climate change and what's going on. We didn't start there, but we really have a problem, and it's right here in front of us. You've seen the fires in Australia and the information that's coming down from the international governmental panels that we've run out of time. We don't have any more time to do it. And so when I talk to people, you know, that can be very depressing of what's happening. And I think we all need a positive story in a way that we, right here in our region or our state or our town or on our woodlot, we could do something that could be a real positive change and be a real player in making something good happen here. And so when I talk to those small family owners, you know, we're a family, we've lived on our property for 40 years, we've got 200 acres. I can tell them, you can be part of a big change here, positive change for the climate. They get pretty excited. You know, they begin to look at their woodlot and their trees in a different way. Instead of growing trees for boards or growing trees for wildlife, they're saying, we're part of the climate movement here, and we're doing something really positive. And we'd like those people to be acknowledged and respected for doing that. And I think now it's the time that the light's going to be shine upon them. You know, the last challenge here is, how do we get more money to make all this happening? And we believe that will start to happen as we articulate the potential. But also, I think climate change is real. It's happening. It's getting worse. We're beginning to understand that. And I believe that we are going to address it in the near future. And when we address it, we're going to have to make an investment to fix it. And we're really trying to line ourselves up for when that moment happens. We're able to say, here's what the forest of New England can do. If you want to make an investment here, here's what we can do, and here's how it will pay off.
Oh, Bob, this has been great. This has been really fabulous. Thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I just like to hear your story. I mean, the great thing about doing this for me is that I get to talk to some or listen to some amazing people who are doing such positive work in many different areas. And I love to hear their stories, and yours is really compelling and very inspirational.
I just want to offer, we're New England Forestry Foundation. We're headquartered in Littleton, Massachusetts. We're right literally off of 495 exit. You can, you know, half a mile. We've got 120 acres, a pond, a hill with a beautiful view. And we got a lot of action going on there in the office. And we like people to stop by when they're driving and check in. So everybody, the offer is there to visit us at headquarters. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we have 150 properties. Get out there and enjoy them.
Bob, thanks again.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.